You know that we're doing this episode about crying.
I know that we're doing an episode about crying.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, it's my podcast, and I'll cry if I want to. Joining me in the studio is producer Antonia Cerejido.
When I was an intern, I was having a really hard day, and I went into the bathroom, and I just cried. And to make myself feel better, I came back out, and I started to do these, like, calculations of how many other Latinos were crying in New York City at the same time as me. So what I did is I went onto the Wikipedia page, and according to them, women cry between 30 and 64 times a year, and men cry between 6 and 17 times a year. So there are 2 million Latinos living in New York, and I did some kind of multiplication and division, and I reached a number for what I thought the number of other Latinos crying in New York City at the same time as me was. And the number I got was 646.
People, not 646,000, 646 people.
Like, other Latinos were crying at the exact same time that I was crying.
I didn't know that you were a mathematical whiz, but okay.
I don't think I am.
I don't think you are either.
Then I kind of wondered, I was like, well, I'm basing these numbers just based off of, like, how many Latinos there are in New York City. But what if Latinos cry at, like, a way higher rate? I was like, then how am I even supposed to try to calculate this? And that's sort of what spurred this curiosity in me, which was like, do Latinos cry more? Because it's sort of, I think the stereotype is that we do.
We're very known to be very dramatic, very emotional. I mean, people immediately probably think of the telenovelas, the close-up on the fake tear, you know, that is just streaming down at the exact right time.
It's funny that you say that, because for this story, I interviewed Jaime Camil, who most people here in the States probably know as Rogelio de la Vega from Jane the Virgin. And I asked him about his experience with crying on set.
Like, I've worked with an actress once, and she was like, you know, the director, I swear to God, I'm not making this up. The director was like, okay, on the second letter M of the word mama, I want a tear from your left eye.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the what? Well, nailed it.
Oh, my
second
gosh.
Second letter of the word mama, a tear fell from her freaking left eye. And I was like, so amazed. I had to cut the scene because I was like, oh, my God, you did it. Jaime, please stay on the scene. I'm like, I'm sorry, man. This is like sending a rocket to the space. I mean, this is like incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a Mexican soap opera star.
In Brazil, they call the Mexican novelas the great Mexican tragedies because no one is happy. There's not one happy episode. Just the first one and the last one. Everything in between, everybody cries.
There's even a meme that has become the symbol of tears in the telenovela. You know that Soraya Montenegro meme?
The Soraya Montenegro meme? No, I don't know it. No.
So Itatí Cantoral was this famous Mexican soap star, and she played this, like, villainous character, Soraya Montenegro. And for some reason, this, like, one still of her, like, doing the one tear falling from her eye where it looks really intense, and the caption underneath says, cries in Spanish, became really popular.
You know, it's like, oh, right.
It's
She's
like there's
crying in Spanish.
It's like there's crying and then there's crying in Spanish. It's like a totally other genre of crying. So I asked Jaime about how he prepares for scenes in which he has to cry.
One physical trick there is that if you close your eyes and you take three deep breaths, like really slow and deep breaths, one, two, three, and then on the fourth deep breath, as you are inhaling, you open your eyelids very slowly. At the same time you're inhaling, and then do not blink for your life. Do not blink. And then you're there. And then you have to add to that the emotion, where you're coming from, the acting, the what you want to transmit to the audience. And, you know, it's not about having water in your eyes. That does nothing to the heart or the emotion of the audience. That does nothing. That's just a physical thing that your body does to lubricate your eyeballs. I mean, you know, if there is no emotion there, if there is no purpose, then there's no context. There's no emotion to transmit.
So telenovelas have been popular in Latin America for decades. The first one actually came out in 1959. It was called El Precio del Cielo. It was in Mexico. But since then, telenovelas have just become like the fundamental thing you watch on TV in most countries in Latin America. In the 60s, there was a novela called Simplemente María. And it was so popular that when the fictional María in the show got married in the show, 10,000 fans showed up to the church to support her and her fictional marriage. And to me, it's this emotional connection, the emotion behind crying, that is what makes crying so interesting.
It is amazing. It is a, ¿cómo se llama? Es una olla express. The pressure cooker for your soul. Pressure cooker?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
Sounds so awkward. Pressure cooker. Cooker. The word cooker is the one that is like getting me. Okay. Yeah, I mean, crying is amazing. It's super comforting and it's nice.
And so today we're going to explore this pressure cooker for the soul and ask, do Latinos cry more? What's been the cultural or historical significance of crying in Latin America versus here in the States? I had a really hard time figuring out where to start this exploration. I was feeling very lost. And so I conducted a highly unscientific study to see whether Latinos cry more.
I love Antonia's highly unscientific studies.
So I gathered a group of six Latinos, three.
So big? Six?
a really great sample size, a really indicative sample size. Anyway, six Latinos, three Latina women, three Latino men, and then I had six non-Latinos, two white men, one Asian man, two white women, and one black woman. And I sent them the same survey every day for 2 weeks. And I didn't tell them it was a survey about crying. I told them it was a caffeine survey. So all the questions were things like, did you have caffeine today? Was it in a tea form? Was it in a coffee form? Like, how energetic were you feeling? But the last question was, did you do any of these things today? Laugh, cry, see what I did there? Dance or call a parent? And I sent the email for 2 weeks. I got back the results every day. And today, I finally tallied up who cried more. And the results of this highly unscientific study,
oh my God, I am
think,
like filled with suspense.
Are really interesting. Do you have any guesses?
You know, my immediate was, obviously it's going to show that Latinos and Latinas cry more. And then I'm like, don't be so fast. Wait a second.
So before we get into my results and find out if Maria is correct, I think it's important that we learn some history and find out where this stereotype even came from before we can prove or disprove it. So I reached out to perhaps the most preeminent expert of crying here in the U.S.
This is Tom Lutz. I'm the author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears.
So what is the earliest record of tears?
The earliest one I found was a clay shard, a pottery shard in the Sumerian desert that tells the stories from the 14th century BC. It tells the story of the death of Baal, and his sister Isis finds him dead and weeps over his body, and those tears bring him back to life. So it's a kind of classic story.
Pre-Columbian groups, like the Aztecs, were known for crying specifically to reinforce requests, like when a provincial ruler would ask the Aztec emperor for aid. Tears would have been offered to the rain god Tlaloc in exchange for the end of a drought. Anthropologists have found artifacts that depict not just Aztec, but also Incan gods weeping. But as far as European culture goes, it seems the obsession with crying, or at least its depiction, came a little later.
Painters couldn't quite figure out how to do tears for a while. So Hans Memling in the Renaissance is the first one to really do good representations of tears in painting.
While tears may have been having their heyday in Renaissance paintings, across the Atlantic, a legend, maybe the most iconic crying legend, was being born in Mexico. Maria, what do you think it was?
You're talking about La Llorona?
Todos me dicen el negro.
Llorona. There's multiple versions of the legend of La Llorona, but one version goes as follows. There was a young woman named Maria.
Great name.
And Maria fell in love with a nobleman, and they had two kids together. And they were happy, but the problem was that their relationship was not sanctioned by the church. And so Maria wanted to marry this nobleman, but the nobleman's mother was like, no way. And Maria was devastated and also enraged. And so she did something horrible.
Oh, no, no.
You know what she did.
It's a terrible thing. She killed her children.
She drowned her two kids in the river and then also drowned herself. And so now she's been doomed to roam the earth going, ay, ¿dónde están mis hijos?
Crying.
Yeah, wailing. Yeah. So La Llorona is the wailing woman. And that is one of the most well-known legends in all of Mexico and in many parts of Latin America. Okay, so this all happened in the 17th century in Mexico and then it spread across into different Latin American countries. But in Europe, there was this big shift that just changed basically like the way everything works in Europe. And it really had a huge impact, particularly on the way people worked.
Only in the 19th century, when we start to get prohibitions of male crying, and that is, I feel, completely related to the rise of the industrial workplace that made it very important for people to be able to get through the day without having a lot of emotional friction and noise in the equation.
So you're saying, like, with the rise of machinery, people were expected to act more like machines, sort of?
That's not exactly the way I ever thought of it, but I like that. I think that makes sense to me.
Which leads me sort of to this theory that it's not necessarily that Latinos cry more. It's just that at one point, Anglo-Saxons were conditioned to cry less, or at least less openly. These same socioeconomic changes just didn't happen in the same way in Latin America. In Mexico, they had their own revolution in the early 1900s, and it was during that time that one of the most recognized forms of Mexican music started to gain popularity.
Rancheras?
Yes, ranchera music.
Bing, 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 bing. Coming up on Latino USA, we learn about that magical crying spell that rancheras cast on weeping tequila drinkers. Stay with us. No te vayas. Este amor apasionado anda todo alborotado.
So, how many candidates are running for president?
22. Maybe more to come. It is a lot to keep track of, which is why the NPR Politics podcast is hitting the road to introduce you to all the people running for president.
Join us on the campaign trail as we interview the candidates to ask why they are the best pick for president. Follow along this spring and summer by subscribing to the NPR Politics podcast.
We're back. Our producer, Antonia Cerejido, decided to call up Adrián Florido, who's a reporter for NPR's Code Switch. She wants to ask him about rancheras.
So, Adrián, you and I met for the first time at a conference.
Yeah.
And I was telling you that I was working on this kooky story about crying. And immediately you were like, oh, that makes me think of this essay that I read. So can you tell me a little bit about the essay?
Yeah. Like, well, one of my favorite writers on Latin America is a woman, a journalist named Alma Guillermo Prieto, who used to write about Latin America for The New Yorker. She wrote an essay. She starts the essay. Can I read some of it for you?
Yeah, yeah.
Mexicans know that a party has been outstandingly successful if at the end of it, there are at least a couple of clusters of long-time or first-time acquaintances leaning on each other against a wall, sobbing helplessly. The activities one normally associates with a party, flirting and conversation, and even the kind of dancing that leads to an amnesiac dawn in a strange bed, are considered here mere preludes to or distractions from the ultimate goal, which is weeping and the free, luxurious expression of pain. And a casual observer of this ritual might conclude that the essential Mexican fin de fiesta cannot happen without alcohol. Not so. It cannot happen without ranchera music.
I love that. What exactly is a ranchera song?
So ranchera is, it's like a traditional genre of Mexican music, which originated in the rural countryside in Mexican ranchos, you know. And so they're just traditional songs that are generally about like love or patriotism, and almost always about like pain or unrequited love or heartbreak.
So did you grow up listening to ranchera music?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, like, she's right. Like, Mexican parties end that way.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, you can ask any Mexican kid who grew up waking up on Saturday and Sunday mornings doing, the Sunday cleaning, and then just, my mom would, blast the Vicente Fernandez as we were, taking out the trash and stuff. So, you know, like, ranchera music is just, a part of the soundtrack of life, you know?
You were telling me that you had heard of a woman who had a similar experience to you growing up, where her parents would blast ranchera music.
I am Beatriz Garcia Meads. I am 43 years old, and I live in San Antonio, Texas.
So Beatriz, she goes by B usually. Both of her parents are Mexican, and when she was little, they lived in a working-class neighborhood in San Antonio. But she told me that her dad did really well for himself.
When I was 13, we moved to a neighborhood with a golf course and a country club.
She ended up being surrounded by, you know, mostly white people. And Beatriz actually described herself as like able to pass for white herself. So she said it was pretty easy for her to blend in.
And in my quest to fit in, I guess, I aligned myself with all the people that I was surrounded by. And so was very disconnected from being a Garcia, if you will.
She was like trying to blend in, trying to pretend like she wasn't Mexican. And then like on Sunday mornings, her parents are blasting Vicente, right? She remembers the way that her parents and other members of her family would get when they listened to this music, like the emotional connection they would have with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd have these like parties. Por tu maldito amor, por tu maldito amor. And after a few songs, as the night wore on, like people had a few drinks, like we were saying, and they'd be singing along and they'd get like really emotional. But B, she didn't get why this happened.
Oh, I hate to say this, but it was kind of embarrassing. It was just so over the top. And, you know, the pop music that was popular at the time and the music that we listened to when we were in school didn't feel that way. So it was like theater almost, and it was too much.
But B at this time, you know, was listening to like rock and pop of the mid to late 80s. One of the singers that she really liked was Linda Ronstadt, who, you know, did a lot of like rock and jazz and country. Yeah, like, you're no good, or whatever. How does it go?
I don't know that song.
Oh, yeah, you do. I just am not singing it right. So if you didn't know, Antonia, and B, like, certainly did not know this, but Linda Ronstadt is part Mexican.
I heard my father talking about Linda Ronstadt's Canciones de mi Padre.
So this was Linda Ronstadt's album of ranchera music. And it was sort of like Ronstadt's coming out as a Mexican, right? Like, you guys all thought I was this cool, like, hip white girl. Actually, I'm Mexican, too.
And it piqued my interest, and I sought it out. I remember going and finding the CD and listening in secret.
Me desvelo y vivo apasionada.
I loved the music.
So, Antonia, this is an album. Canciones de mi Padre is an album that starts in like this really depressing place, with Bronstedt singing about this love who's left a bitter pain in her life. She says, "Poor me, it would be better if this life would just end. Because of that love, I've cried tears of blood straight from my heart."
Ay, qué dramática, Dios mío.
Can you get any like more cortavenas than that? So here's the thing. Okay, remember how B said that when her family would listen to all these songs, she never understood why they'd get so emotional? Well, the thing about Linda Ronstadt's Canciones de mi Padre was that in the liner notes, she had the Spanish lyrics, but then she also had them translated in English. And so B was following along as she was listening to these songs, and she actually like could understand what Ronstadt was singing about, right?
For the first time, that connection and the stories, the passion, it struck me deeply. It was this idea of this is why people sing in that manner. This is why it's over the top. This is, it's real life.
So B says that Canciones de mi Padre planted this, you know, seed, and it became her gateway, you know, to ranchera music. But also to like sort of start exploring her Mexican culture, her identity, her background, her family's past. She went online and she started getting translations for all these song lyrics.
So did she actually ever cry listening to these rancheras?
Yeah. And she actually told me about the very first time. She went out with her friend to listen to rancheras from the jukebox at the bar near their college.
And as the night wore on, as the beers were consumed, and feeling this love for our culture, our people, for being Mexican. That's when the tears start flowing. It's hard to describe tears feeling like a release, like baptism via tears, if you will.
So since then, you know, B says she's cried countless times listening to rancheras. She's got a huge collection on her phone that she listens to in her car and cries and cries. And at family parties now, when her dad puts on the rancheras like he always has in her entire life, now she gets up with him and her uncle and they just like belt them out together. And B knows what she's singing about, right?
Yeah.
She like finally knows.
Okay, so the cultural power of tears is pretty undeniable. But just because Latinos are like culturally obsessed with tears, does that translate to literal tears? Are Latinos in fact crying more, or at least this random group of six Latinos I tracked for 2 weeks? Before I give the results, I just want to remind everyone that this is not a scientific study. It's so unscientific that all of the participants were friends of friends. But the reason I did that was because to me, this was less about gathering data and more about being able to call someone up and have an honest conversation about why they did or did not cry. And also to tell them the truth, that I was not tracking their caffeine intake. So without further ado, the results. Latinas by and far cried more than any other group.
So you were right, right? And I'm kind of like a little sad about that, too.
I don't know if I was right. It would mirror this idea that Latinos cry more. Of the three Latinas who participated in the survey, one did not cry at all. Another cried on 4 days. And the third woman cried 11 times during 2 weeks. Okay. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
And so I called up Joanna Flores, a therapist in Los Angeles, to talk to her about her experience during the survey. I wasn't actually measuring your caffeine intake.
Oh, no.
I was measuring your crying habits.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, I thought that was an interesting thing to be on there.
And you in particular cried the most out of anyone.
I was going through a breakup.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's not a big deal. And then the other thing is, I think I'm really comfortable with crying. I think it's like it's a way to manage your feelings and emotions. And for me, crying is safe, and I get it out of my system, and I process it, and then I move on.
Yeah. So do you think it has more to do with you being a therapist than with you being Latina?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think as a Latina, I emote more.
While Latinas were the ones that cried at the highest rates, not one of the Latino men cried during these 2 weeks I measured.
Interestingly, you know, in my household, I saw my dad cry once.
In your whole life?
Well, when he got older and had Alzheimer's, then, you know, then he would cry.
Yeah.
But as a grown man, only once.
I called up Ernesto Lucar, a Peruvian man who lives in New York City and works in advertising, to ask him why he didn't cry.
I usually cry when it's like really, really extreme, like when somebody passes away or when frustration is just like impossible to handle. But yeah, I'm not that much of a crier, I guess.
So the whole segment is I'm asking the question, do Latinos cry more? And what do you think?
I don't know. I guess it depends on your upbringing. And I guess also as boys, like we grew up being told that we're not supposed to cry, you know.
You were told that?
Los niños no lloran. Mm. So I guess it's part of that. And I guess it's also the reason why when we drink, we get so affectionate. It's because we're like repressing those feelings and we need something to like, you know, liberate us.
And so you grew up in Peru.
Yes.
And do you feel, for instance, that there were different pressures there than here?
Yes, certainly. I went to an all-boys Catholic school. And now that I look back, I kind of feel bad for all the guys that later on came out as gay because they told us all sorts of horrible things about being gay. And I'm not sure, at least not in New York, boys grow up with that kind of pressure about like their masculinity and stuff like that.
On to the non-Latinos who I surveyed. The two white women cried a handful of times, and the African-American woman didn't cry at all. The Asian man I surveyed didn't cry once during the 2 weeks, while the two Caucasian ones did. Tommy McNamara, who is a stand-up comedian and also lives in New York City, is the last person I spoke to get some more insight on the survey.
Okay, so I have to admit something to you, which is this wasn't a caffeine survey.
Whoa. I'm shocked.
Are you shocked?
Yeah, no, I am. What was it?
We were studying crying, tears.
Oh, okay. Did I cry in my...
You did.
I did once? Oh, I don't even remember what it was.
I think you cried more than once.
Oh, no. It's been a tough year. Like, maybe it was the day I saw a Lady Bird or something. Or maybe... There was like one day, Christmas Eve, where I was like really stressed out about travel and I had like missed my family's Christmas Eve party because my flight got delayed. So I was like, maybe that was it.
Do you remember crying?
I don't specifically, but I can see that happening, you know?
Well, I mean, you don't feel like you cry often, actually?
If I had to guess, I would say it was like 2 to 3 times a year.
Even though you cried like 3 times during the day.
But that's also probably me projecting what I want, thinking that I'm John Wayne.
It was so crazy to me that Tommy didn't remember crying, but it reminded me of something Professor Lutz told me about crying experiments.
One of the things about this British study in the 20th century was that men who measurably cried, that is, people saw their eyes well up, saw a teardrop, would claim that they did not cry. Whereas women who just kind of got a little moist in the eye and didn't drop any tears at all would report that they had cried. So the reporting always follows the kind of sense of your proper role, what you're supposed to be doing.
So you did a lot of looking at not at both like the cultural history and then also at scientific works.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any way I can definitively prove whether Latinos cry more?
No. No, absolutely not. Again, the research methods are simply not there. I'm sure there's a way in which we could eventually stick a chip in people and have the a perfect measurement of the amount of tears that different people cry.
I have to say, listening to him talk, it made me feel so good because I've been feeling like Zoe, your assistant, used to do research at NYU. And she was like, this study is garbage. And now knowing that all the studies are garbage makes me feel like a better scientist. The truth is, I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist. But there is one thing that scientists and journalists have in common, and that's that when we start our work, we always start with a question. And maybe the reason I'm not getting exact answers is because I'm asking the wrong question. I started doing these weird crying experiments because I was going through a hard time and I wanted to feel better and I wanted to feel comforted. And the truth is that after I cry, I do tend to feel better. And so maybe the better question is, why is that? Even Professor Lutz told me that in the first example of crying that he found, there is proof that crying is associated with soothing.
And the shard reads, she continued weeping, sating herself with tears, drinking of them like wine. And that, for me, was a kind of a real moment of revelation because I thought, wow, this is the earliest tears we can find represented. And they're already talking about tears not as simply mourning, but tears as a form of pleasure, of auto-intoxication.
Before I did my fake caffeine survey, you and I had started sort of like our own experiment a couple years back.
Right. And actually, it was a particularly challenging and sad year for me. Three of the people closest to me were actually dying. My father, my best friend, Cecilia Weissman, who actually was your professor in college and who introduced you to us, and my very best friend, cousin, Maritere. So yeah, I was crying a lot that year.
Every time you cried, you would send me a voice memo. And I just like wonder if you remember that time and what you remember of it.
God, I'm getting all teary-eyed. I swear. Oh, my God.
So this was one of the times when I have cried the most intensely. I'm going to have to go to Mexico immediately. And to just the realization that he's really, I don't know, in his last days, weeks, months for sure. Tonight I had to cry with my whole family, with my husband holding me and then my daughter holding me. It's like, oh God, it was so terrible and it was so uncontrollable. It was like this all the time. All the time. Phew.
It's not like this all the time. As you can see, what I've learned now is to also stop it.
You know, we've been talking all this time about like Latinos cry all the time, blah, blah, blah. That year was not normal. It was not a normal year for you. Like listening to the memos, it became really evident to me that you were going through something. There was one study that Professor Lutz told me about that I think is really relevant to the experience that you had.
So if you think of any emotional experience as something which takes us from homeostasis, our normal steady state, gets us all worked up so that our heart rate goes up, our pulse goes up. Eventually, whatever that emotional experience is, that it doesn't last forever. It goes up and then eventually comes back down and we reach homeostasis again. And there are a number of studies that tried to figure out when exactly tears start in that process. The majority of them showed that the tears start after the peak of that physiological experience. And therefore, it kind of makes sense that we associate tears with feeling better.
That's so scientific, but so fascinating.
Well, I think that for you, crying was like you trying to get back to normal.
Okay. Hold on. I was not prepared for you to be dropping like that kind of... So basically what you're saying is that me going into this, you know, tearful state that lasted months upon months upon months was actually me trying to get back to normal faster.
Yeah, I really think that is what happened.
Bunk. Blink. the kind of continual crying and the allowing myself to cry was, in a way, a gift, I guess, that these three last loved ones of mine, mi papá, mi prima Maritera, my cousin Maritere, and then my best friend Cecilia, it was almost like they were like, this is going to be really tough, but what it's going to help you do is to get to the other side faster, and you're going to need that. I didn't want to be in a perpetual state of mourning because it can go on forever, and it can be all-encompassing.
Even if Latinos don't cry more than any other group, which at this point is like, who knows? I take immense comfort in knowing that all of us, Latino or otherwise, we have this ability to do this thing, which could seem crazy. Like, why does water fall out of eyeballs? That's like a weird thing. But it has this power of letting us know, like, oh, you're going back to a place where you will feel normal. And that in and of itself is just such a comforting thought to me. And thank you for going on this journey of tears with me.
I feel like I've learned so much, and I'm okay with crying. I'm still okay with crying. I'm actually better with crying now than maybe when we started. Although I'm really happy to not be crying a lot. Thank you, Antonia. And if you're not done crying yet, you can check out our playlist of popular songs to cry to that was curated by our Twitter followers at our website, latinousa.org. This episode was produced by Antonia Cerejido and edited by Nadia Raymond. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Fernanda Camarena and Sofia Paliza Ka, with additional editing by Marlon Bishop. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Jess Alvarenga. Our intern is Lucas Southard. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I also want to tell you about something exciting that's happening. Once again, we're partnering with Summer Stage in their 2019 season here in New York City. Get ready for a summer filled with the best music from around the world, with nearly 100 performances across all 5 boroughs in New York City. Check out the just-announced lineup at summerstage.org and look for us, Latino USA. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by WK Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Are you okay?
Am I okay?
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a portrait of slam poet and award-winning author Elizabeth Acevedo. That's next time on Latino USA.
James Reeb was fatally beaten on Selma Street in 1965. His death would galvanize the nation.
But in a courtroom 9 months later, a not guilty verdict was handed down.
In episode 2, the trial and the birth of a conspiracy theory.
From NPR, it's White Lies. Listen and subscribe now.